The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 16th of February 2023 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. Hello and a very warm welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up in the next 30 minutes, the bombardment of Ukraine intensifies. Intelligence reports of a rise in the number of air attacks by Russia. We'll have the latest. Also ahead.
There were questions as soon as his name was announced as to what credibility he was bringing into this job, and especially his position on climate change.
The president of the World Bank, David Malpass, resigns overnight. We'll cross over to Washington, D.C. to find out why. We'll flick through the day's newspapers, and it's Thursday, which means Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with his weekly global countdown. What do you have for us today, Faye? Something special?
Very special, Emma. Are you ready to dance, by the way? I'll guide you through the carnival hits of 2023.
I'll get limbering up. More from Fernando a little later. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. The number of Russian air attacks carried out against Ukraine has risen in the last week. British military intelligence reported the rise, with the number of strikes now comparable to summer last year. The latest Russian strikes hit infrastructure around the west of Ukraine's region as heavy fighting continues in the east. Well, for an update, I'm delighted to say the journalist Natalia Gumnenyuk joins me on the line from Ukraine. Good afternoon to you, Natalia.
Good afternoon from Kyiv.
So just tell us, what's the latest?
So indeed, people are anticipating, you know, something, because there are serious reports on the possible larger offense as Russia is mobilizing its troops closer to the anniversary of the invasion. And yes, you mentioned there are many attacks, but what to explain that, you know, they are now targeted not just to the capital, because usually, you know, they are in the news when the capital is targeted or any major town. But, you know, there are a lot of smaller towns around the country near the Russian border, near the line of the, you know, separation, like Kherson, where you regularly hear yesterday, today, a lady of 79 years old died in Pavlograd in Dnipro region. An elderly lady has been shot by the shrapnel in Kherson today. Another, you know, six people had been wounded in a small town in Kharkiv region. So it's happening. You know, unfortunately, when it's not a major attack on one house in a bigger town, it has lesser attention. So it's still devastating, because you understand that the air defense in the bigger towns like Odessa or Kyiv or the capital, it's better. You know, so even if there are regular today attacks by the Iranian drones or by the Russians, the Ukrainian air defense is ready to defend some of the major, you know, places or the capital. But it's more unfortunate for the smaller towns, especially those which are closer to the front line.
Do we know what Russia is trying to achieve here? Because we've seen in the past, when there have been deliberate targeting of infrastructure such as power plants, water supplies, when you strike big cities, it's to unsettle and undermine seats of power and influence. But if you start to target smaller towns, what effect does that have on you in Ukraine?
So first of all, the attacks on the infrastructure is still going on, but there is something which has happened. First, the major power plants were for for the all this period were attacked in big towns, and they are big. It's easy to target them. I think since then, Ukraine managed to, you know, diversify the energy supply. So, for instance, for the first time for the 3 days in Kyiv, I constantly hear that there is no power cuts. Ukraine has enough energy. Some of the things were fixed, some are hidden. So it's going on, but it's not that successful. If you speak about the other towns, I think there is no surprise that the tactics is about terrorizing Ukraine. So, for instance, what is a painful thing for me is the town of Kherson, which is liberated. So setting the rockets back can't be perceived anything but revenge, just, you know, to make life of the people unbearable. With the less expensive ammunition, which Russian ammunition, I mean, I'm speaking about the Russians, who, you know, they have lesser missiles, which can be, which are very sophisticated and could be very precise to target the capital. But they have a lot on the border when they can just shell and shell and shell in order to, you know, spoils people's life. It has nothing, it's not very smart from the military strategy, but it's still tragic for the people.
Is there a sense, at least there is from the outside, that there is a build-up being made by Russia ahead of next week's anniversary of its invasion of Ukraine? Do you get that sense where you are?
So I'm in Kyiv. The discussion about that are there for the last months. The government is pretty serious about that. It's believed that still the build-up would be in the Donbas and closer to the Russian border in Kharkiv region. As you know, there are less today beliefs that there could be attack from the Belarus, from the north on Kyiv, like it was year before. Also because Ukraine is, but it also stretches the Ukrainian resources. So of course it's more fortified. There are, you know, Ukrainian troops on the northern border as well. They believe that it's mainly the destruction that they cannot kind of have all the people closer to the you know, front line. Or and also Ukraine is also considering a counter offense, because that's also the only way. The further Ukrainian troops are pushing the Russians, the lesser they attack the Ukrainian towns, the less damage they create for the population.
There are reports that there's frustration being expressed by the international community in Germany in particular, saying that the promises that Ukraine would receive Leopard 2 tanks in order for it to defend itself from any fresh onslaught by Russia is not happening as quickly as it should do. He's been singling out several countries for not sending the tanks when they say that they would. How does that make you feel in Ukraine when you know that the rest of the world is still deciding and trying to sort itself out in order to help you?
I think Ukrainians cannot afford to be frustrated. You know, it might be disappointed, in particular because there is a clear understanding. You know, I'm a journalist. I live in Kyiv, but I'm a Ukrainian citizen, and I'm well informed. And on a daily basis, I read the news about that person died, that soldier, you know, or the colleague, relative, or somebody in the front line. I'm meaning like the people who are fighting. So it's very clear. And I heard these talks from, you know, a veteran whom I knew, who said like, oh, my platoon has lost today 8 people because we didn't have, you know, a proper military vehicle. If they had something else, they might have survived. So it's very clear. But I think that quite a lot has been done. The Ukrainians are quite confident that, you know, the most important is to start. The fact that the Leopard are given, it means that more would follow. It's very important to break this ice, you know, and that if already this ammunition is supplied, most probably we wish it would be faster. Ukraine needs it to be faster. It's still the West kind of lagging behind, and that's unfortunate because it's less efficient. It's in the end cost more in the end. But what to do? You know, the result on the ground is what we have at this moment.
Natalia Gumnyenyuk on the phone, on the line, I should say, from Kyiv. Many thanks. We're very grateful for your time. The time here in London is 12:08. A quick summary now from Carlotta Ribello of the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. The suspected Chinese spy balloon that was shot down while crossing the United States was originally set to head over Guam and Hawaii before being blown off course by winds. The device drifted across Alaska, Canada and central U.S. before being shot down by the U.S. military last week. A government commission in Russia has approved the sale of the factories of IKEA, the Swedish furniture maker, to two local buyers. It follows a decision by several Western companies to leave Russia after it launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year. IKEA hopes to finalize the terms early this year. And the websites of at least three German airports are disrupted today. It comes a day after a major IT failure at Lufthansa, which left thousands of passengers stranded at Frankfurt Airport. German ground crew is also due to strike tomorrow over remuneration issues. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you very much indeed, Carlotta. Now, the president of the World Bank, David Malpass, is to step down a year early. Mr. Malpass was the choice of the former US President Donald Trump. He was criticised as a climate change denier, but no reason has been given for his departure. Let's get the latest from Monocle's Washington correspondent, Chris Chermak. A very good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Emma.
So what's happened?
Well, as you suggest there, it was actually a surprise resignation from David Malpass last night or yesterday evening. He didn't give a specific reason for his departure early. His term ends in April 2024. He said he would stay on until the end of this fiscal year of the World Bank, which is June. And on the one hand, yes, this was a surprise yesterday, but for insiders, at the very least, this does appear to be somewhat coordinated. Joe Biden, the U.S. president, did want to appoint a World Bank president already when he came into office. But of course, you know, the World Bank president typically sits a five-year term, and that was not something that he could demand. But at the same time, it seems like over the past few weeks, this is something that has been coordinated somewhat with the U.S. administration. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently, just last week, kind of urged the World Bank to do more, particularly on climate financing and sort of making climate integral to what it does as an institution, as well as other reforms. And that's really been the key in terms of some of the criticisms that you've had of David Malpass over the last few years. As you mentioned there, he was an appointee of Donald Trump. And that, you know, it seems like something at least came to a head, whether it was a personal decision of David Malpass to kind of force this or the fact that the White House wants to move specifically on climate financing for developing countries. You know, we don't know the exact details from the inside of that, but it does seem like this was something coordinated.
Indeed. I mean, one wonders how much of a hangover of the Trump era Mr. Malpass is, or rather was. We've both mentioned the issue of his climate change denial comments. How much did that push him out?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think climate was a key element of this. You know, back in September, there was this very sort of comment that went around the world that really highlighted his potential climate denial. We don't know exactly where he stands on this, it should be said. But there was this moment where he was asked by a reporter whether fossil fuels contributed to climate change or not. And he's just responded, well, I'm not a scientist. And that was the comment that sort of started much of this. But at the same time, I have to say, you know, as we've both mentioned, he was a Trump appointee. And so beyond that, really, you know, even though this September comments from him were the ones that raised questions, the White House at that point did not call for his resignation. He clarified his remarks and said, of course, climate change is man-made. And he sort of did a little turnabout on that. But, you know, I spoke with Nadia Dar. She is the head of the Washington Office of Oxfam International, an organization, charity that has worked hard on World Bank reform. And she talked about the fact that, you know, climate change, this question of climate change has really hung over David Malpass since the beginning of his term. Let's have a little listen.
There were questions as soon as his name was announced as to what credibility he was bringing into this job, and especially his position on climate change. It took a long time for him to even start using terminology like climate change. And really that kind of lack of leadership on climate change was just so highly, highly evident. So that was one thing that was difficult for an institution that should be playing a leadership role and that is doing a lot of work, but where the leadership was just not magnifying that and not demonstrating the kind of leadership that we would need and expect from such a large development institution.
Now, one thing that Nadia Dar did say and others say as well is that, you know, David Malpass did well on other things, like particularly the pandemic, helping with crisis financing, also on Ukraine and Russia, helping developing countries manage their debts. So that was something that was key in terms of a positive of his tenure. But as she suggests there, and as we've seen also partly because of the climate summit in Egypt, as well, where there was a push for more additional climate financing, that really seems to be what did him in the end.
So the question is, has to be asked, who replaces him?
So this is the key, always interesting question, Emma. There is a essentially gentleman's agreement, if you will, between the World Bank and the IMF that the United States picks the president of the World Bank and Europe picks the president, or the managing director, I should say, of the International Monetary Fund. This is something that has happened for a long time. Therefore, in theory, at least, this does fall to Joe Biden. And the U.S. Treasury Department is involved. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said there would be an appointment, a nomination of a new leader. This is something that Joe Biden is quite eager to do. That said, there is always this push for that gentleman's agreement to be lifted. I asked Nadia Dar of Oxfam International about this as well. Let's have a little listen to what she said.
The World Bank is almost 80 years old. We're talking about setting it up for the future. You know, all these discussions about this evolution roadmap and how can the bank be fit for purpose. But we're stuck in this archaic colonial relic of a gentleman's agreement where the U.S. still determines who the leader of this multilateral development institution is, and where Europeans get to decide who the leader of the International Monetary Fund is. You know, if we're talking about fairness, if we're talking about good governance, if we're talking about making sure that the institution is working for people in the global south, and then not to even have the possibility for the leadership of that institution to come from the global south is absolutely mad.
That was Chris Chermak there, talking to us a little bit earlier on from Washington. Let's stay in the world of business and check what other stories are making the headlines. To help us do that, I'm joined by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Hello, Ewan.
Hi, Emma. Good to speak to you.
Tell us about corporate profits. They have passed their peak.
Yeah, US corporate profits have been, US companies have been seeing their fattest profits in 70 years over the last couple of years. That's really helped to sustain a pandemic hiring spree by US business. Now it looks like margins are starting to shrink, and that could signal harder times ahead for the jobs market. Now, I have to stress this is forward-looking stuff, because at the moment the US job market is very healthy. The latest monthly job figures we had from the US were really knockout. Economists were expecting the US economy to have created something in the region of 180,000-190,000 jobs. It's actually created 500,000 jobs over the course of the month. So the job market is very rosy at the moment, although certain sectors, particularly tech, are seeing a lot of layoffs. But looking at earnings reports over the recent period, we've just finished earnings season in the US, getting towards the end of it. And the bulk of reports are showing per share earnings down 2% on average. And that is the first decline in those since the first quarter of 2020. So we're starting to see the shine coming off on the corporate profit front a little bit. An interesting illustration of that over here in Europe, the world's biggest food company, Nestle, looks like it's reaching the limits of its pricing power. Now, we've discussed this before about how consumer goods companies can pass on higher inflation, those higher costs, into higher prices. And at the beginning of the inflationary spiral, it looked like they were getting away with it. Now it seems they are not. Volumes at Nestle dropped by 2.5%. It was the second consecutive quarter where the amount of products Nestle sold dropped. Total sales, of course, have gone up because prices are going up, but the volume has decreased. The last time that Nestle's volume was negative before that was right back in 1999.
Okay, we'll move on to international trade relations. Politically, China and Australia, well, their trade relations are improving, even if politically it's not getting better.
Yeah, the freeze is over. That was what apparently was said by the Chinese to the Australian Trade Minister. We spoke to Trade Minister Don Farrell on Bloomberg a little bit earlier today, and they're going to be having a meeting to discuss the further thawing of relations. The tensions didn't occur overnight, he told us, and they're not going to be resolved overnight, but it does seem like we're seeing quite a warming. Apparently the Chinese trade minister said to him that the freeze is over and we're now moving to a warm spring. Now, you'll remember that back in 2020, China placed an immediate moratorium on the import of Australian coal, a very large amount of trade between the two countries in that sector. That was after Prime Minister Scott Morrison called for an international investigation into the origins of COVID in Wuhan. The Chinese were not happy with that. The embargo then extended to other areas, including wine, barley and lobsters. Of course, China is Australia's most important trade partner, and this has been pretty bad for the Australian economy. It does seem like that whole relationship is starting to warm up.
Ewan Potts from Bloomberg, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing. You're back with The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 12:20. Let's have a look at the papers. I am delighted to say that Monocle's deputy head of radio, Tom Webb, has come into the studio brandishing a copy of the New York Times.
I've just come running in. I'm out of breath, and it's the biggest paper in the world to sort of hold on to.
Well, it's fine. It's a healthy size. It's perfect. No smaller, no bigger.
Before we go into the New York Times, I wanted to start with the Japan Times and a story about vending machines.
What's
the strangest item you've ever purchased from a vending machine?
I have a comfortably pedestrian existence, which means that the most exciting thing that I've ever managed to get out of a vending machine, well, it wasn't quality but quantity. There was a vending machine in a place I used to work which couldn't work out that if you put in, let's say, 50p for a chocolate bar, it had been badly programmed or just broken so that the entire contents of that row would dispense themselves to you. So you just got an overload of caramels or an overload of chocolates. And it took a good full 6 months for the people who operated this thing to work out that everybody cleared everything out by 10 o'clock in the morning and then were all wildly ill by 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's my idea of a great vending machine.
It was a wonderful vending machine. And those funny things that you used to clean your teeth that looked like bottle brushes. that you only seem to get in motorway service stations.
Well, unrelated to this story, there is a mashed potato vending machine in Singapore.
Is it any good?
Yeah, for a dollar, you can have gravy with it as well.
Wow. Warm or cold?
Warm.
Good. Have you had it?
No, I haven't.
That's a shame. I was hoping. With or without gravy.
But totally distracting from the story here. In Japan, vending machines have tumbled by 30% since 2000, and that's due to a population decline and intensifying competition with convenience stores. But the pandemic has triggered a huge change in behaviour. A lot of people want high-end cuisine, but they don't want to go out. They still want to stay in. And we've seen that in-person eating and drinking still hasn't recovered. It's still 60% of pre-pandemic levels. So food dispensing machines have become a rare spark of growth in the sector. Brand new high-tech machines, they are 6 foot tall, and they allow...
Well, that rules me out, because I'm 5 foot three.
Oh, no, the buttons are nice and low.
Okay, that's fine.
We are in Japan, remember. You can buy frozen and chilled versions of your favourite dishes from Michelin Guide-listed soup noodles, sashimi, Wagyu steak, and even caviar. Do you like Wagyu steak?
I love Wagyu steak, and I'm learning to cook it, actually, at the moment. Now, which makes me think, because when you go and choose your piece of Wagyu, obviously, the cattle themselves have been on a very gentle, delicate, wonderful journey involving massages and beer and what have you. You know, as they go to meet their maker, they go with a smile on their lovely faces. To end up in a vending machine is surely one of the most humiliating things that could happen to a cow, one would argue.
Arguably, yes, but the providers are very, very upmarket.
Right, okay. A posh vending machine.
And this particular owner says that they're interested in evolving the machine to fit even bigger items, such as bento boxes and even large pizzas.
Okay, that's not working for me, for starters. I mean, one wonders, where are these vending machines going to be? Do we know?
Train stations,
okay. So pick me some Wagyu up on the way home, please, honey.
away from the Japan Times, let's go to the Taipei Times. Now, this is largely focused on the Chinese animal. What is your Chinese animal?
I'm a tiger.
So a tiger.
I'm a wood tiger. What are you?
That means I'm a pig, which means I do whatever I want with strength.
Feet in the trough at all times.
A tiger is resilience and strength, even in times of struggle. Does that sound familiar?
Not at all. I'm an absolute pussycat.
So this year is the year of the rabbit.
Yes, and they hopeless for you and me.
Hopeless. Not
dreadful.
Not a good partnership.
No, no, no.
They are gentle,
quiet. Can you
imagine
a tiger and a rabbit? That's just not going to happen. It is. It's going to be quite fluffy.
Well, speaking of fluffy, these rabbits, these people who associate with the Year of the Rabbit, they are going to the Wyoming Temple. It's seen an explosion of visitors because it has a rabbit deity. However, the Wyoming Temple in New Taipei City is also the only temple in the world to provide good luck in love and marriage to Taiwan's gay community.
Lovely.
The rabbit god, whom worshippers call Tai Ye, is the gay counterpart to Yu Lao, who is the old man under the moon.
I'm struggling to keep up here, Tom.
The old man under the moon.
Right.
I was about to make a joke about he's oddly enough a gay deity on Hampstead Heath in London. However, the old man under the moon is the deity responsible for love and marriage.
Okay.
But his gay rabbit counterpart has come from the fact that rabbit is a slur for homosexuals in China, but also a 18th century Chinese official who was beaten to death after peeping on a local inspector who he had feelings for.
This is so complicated.
I know, I'm really sorry. But soon after his death, he appeared as this...
This is the man who's beaten to death?
Yes.
For being a peeping Tom?
Yes, he appeared from the underworld as the rabbit god. And this is the shrine. So... This
is a good thing.
This is a good thing because...
You have a peeping Tom reincarnated as a rabbit god.
Yes.
And that's a good thing.
Yes, because now the gay crowd looking for guidance can go there to improve their marriage. And this really, really lovely quote from the very naive journalist who wrote this piece says that Yu Lao traditionally serves heterosexual people, but some gay men who pray here may end up meeting a lot of new friends. So this temple, a religious institution, has now become a very popular gay haunt. That's the conclusion.
Thank you.
We got there.
We did.
Was it worth it?
Yes, obviously. So worth it. So worth it. So worth it. I'm going to ask you for our next story.
I'm going to have to do it so quickly because I've already overrun explaining why the gay deity is a rabbit. In the New York Times, have you come across assortative mating as a term?
Not recently. It doesn't crop up massively over the Nelson dining table.
Well, all animals do it.
Or anywhere else in the Nelson household, for that matter.
All animals do it. All humans do it. It's about mating with people who are similar to ourselves.
Okay.
And historically, this has been linked to widening inequality because the rich get richer when a doctor marries a doctor. But when a doctor marries a nurse, scandal, the gap narrows. Is this another overcomplicated story?
No, this is fine.
Okay, great.
But we're holding on tight, Tom.
Over the last 30 years, a new report has found that this type of mating and dating is on the decline, which could narrow inequalities in society.
So everyone can play doctors and nurses.
Exactly. Now, there are two things that has caused this trend. Firstly, millennials, God love them, their dating apps are all based on looks. They pick their lover based on how they look on their phones. And also, this is an interesting one, because women have now had greater educational opportunities over the past 30 years, like men, now they want their slice of cake and marry someone who is of their equal. But there is a shortage of unmarried men in high socioeconomic statuses. So women are either remaining single or marrying useless men, which is narrowing inequality.
Thank you, Tom Webb. You're listening to Monocle 24.
The Concierge from Monocle, brought to you in association with Allianz Partners, is coming soon to Monocle 24 and all good audio platforms. Just like Monocle's editors, Allianz Partners is committed to helping you build exceptional experiences. whenever you're traveling. That's what makes this a perfect partnership. The Concierge program brings all the best of Monocle's award-winning and beloved coverage of travel from print and digital to the airwaves. You'll hear insider insights and ideas about where the world is heading, plus tips on packing your bags for the must-see destinations, new openings, and the loveliest spots to lay your head. So get out there and visit the places, enjoy the experiences, and meet the people changing the world of hospitality for the better. The Concierge, in association with Allianz Partners.
And if you've just joined us, welcome. This is The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson, and a special edition of a Thursday regular now. Monocle 24 senior correspondent Fernanda Augusta Pacheco joins me for the weekly global countdown. But this week, Faye, we're not going to a country. Well, we are, but there's a glittery headdress special. It's Carnival Week.
It's Carnival Week, and that's the most important moment for the Brazilian music world. I mean, because that's when artists release the tracks that might do well. And remember, we celebrate Carnival the whole week. I mean, there's a lot of pre-Carnival parties as well. It's a never-ending thing there in Brazil.
So, I mean, looking into the dim and distant past of, let's say, the United Kingdom, everyone who went bananas for the Christmas number one. Do you have the equivalent of a Carnival number one in Brazil?
We do have an equivalent, and I will be talking about this throughout this five songs that I chose.
In fact, six,
because I am a little bit naughty here. And sometimes it's quite organic, sometimes very hard to predict which song actually might do well. Sometimes a top artist releases a hit that doesn't really connect with people. But, you know, we'll look into those examples that I'll give to you.
So are we looking at this year's contenders for Carnival number one?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So is this a sort of like 5-4-3-2-1 position, or is this just what Faye's head has offered us today?
What Faye's head is like my predictions. I'm playing a little bit of a magic game here. It's my predictions.
good. Right. Okay. So who are we starting? Or who or what are we starting with?
Well, I'm starting in a very safe way because she is the Queen of Carnival. She is celebrating 30 years of her career this year. It's the wonderful Ivete Sangalo. I mean, she is a blockbuster name in Brazil. I mean, if she's going to perform, you can be sure that it will be sold out. And, you know, she's still releasing great singles as well. And this is one of them. Could do very well at this year's Carnival. It's called Cria da Ivete, which is something like Ivete's Babies.
Right, okay, well, we start off with a bit of a punch. That's the Queen of Carnival, and you can tell. So tell us a little bit more about this lady, Ivete Sangalo.
She's energetic. She's from Bahia, of course, and that's what, you know, the majority of Brazilian artists, they come from Bahia. It's such a musical state. And the genre she became known as is axé, which, again, was created in Bahia, and is a mixture of several genres. There's a little bit of Afro-Caribbean touch, reggae, calypso, frevo as well from Brazil. It's a very, you have to dance when you listen. Listen to it. And she's fun. She doesn't take herself too seriously. She says in the lyrics, single? No. Happy. You know, if there are drinks, I'll be drinking with my experienced friends.
Your experienced friends.
Whatever that means.
I think we heard about some of them from Tom Webb a little bit earlier on.
Exactly.
Let's move on to, I'm going to get you to spell the name of the next artist because the video requires Googling simply for absolutely all the wrong reasons, unless you are a manufacturer of incredibly adhesive underwear. Because my goodness, do the dancers in this video need it.
I mean, it's incredible the
it
way
is
they
incredible,
dance.
It is, ladies and gentlemen.
It's basically Thaisa Maravilha. She's part of the Bonde das Maravilhas, which is a group of full of kind of female MCs. But they also are dancers as well. Mm. And this new track called Ensaio das Maravilhas, I agree with you, Emma. You do have to Google because there's very complex choreography involved.
Is that what you call it?
That's exactly. For
Excellent.
Example, one of them you have to touch your ankle on your butt. But, you know, when you look at the video, I mean, it's frankly frankly
that's
impossible.
That's the least of our worries, I think, given what's going. I mean, when you're sort of like talking to dance too, it is in inverted commas. I think it's something like twerking, but with about 300 volts being fed through your body at the same time.
But one thing I might agree with you, everybody's talking about twerking. Mm. In Brazil, we've been twerking for decades,
I know.
You know, it's not a new thing for us, you know. It comes very natural.
The master twerker.
Yes, yeah, shall we have a listen to this
please,
song?
And let's limber our hips up for it. Ensaio de Maravillas, is that how you said? Excellent. Look it up. Next one, we're going to somewhere called someone called Tubarão. Who are they?
Yeah, it's a song, Tubarão Te Amo, Shark, I Love You.
Nice.
It's a track full of MCs. I mean, there's a long list of the artists here. And they actually sampled an axé song, the rhythm I was talking to you about, Ivete Sangalo. So this song has a lot of samples in there. It can be a little bit harsh, but young people are loving it. It became viral on TikTok. It's been number one for quite a few months as well. And I think it might continue during Carnival. It's not for everyone, Emma, but let's have a listen. We have a clip of it. Cuidado, tubarão vai te pegar. Tubarão, te amo. Falcão, te amo. Erika, I'm not gonna lie, there's something quite raw about it that I like it, you know?
Oh, it's fine.
I shouldn't like it, but I do. You know, there's something that attracts me to the song.
It's excellent to be played out of a car at 2 o'clock in the morning by badly behaved young people.
Exactly.
It's perfect. Let's move to something a little bit cooler from a group who we have on the playlist but have a really lovely smooth retro style to them.
Absolutely, I think you will love this. Bala Desejo, one of my favorite Brazilian bands of the moment. They released one of my favorite albums again called Sing Sing Sing, and this song is actually about Carnival. It's called Baile de Máscaras, The Masked Ball. And again, when you listen to that, you remind me of the golden age of Brazilian music in the 70s, in the 80s as well. It's beautiful, it's suave, and I'm sure it will do very well in the Carnival blocks as well.
Let's have a swish along to it. You instantly have glossier hair when you listen to
that. Yes, it's dreamy.
Very dreamy.
I love it. Mm. And again, you know, there's space for everyone in Carnival. It used to be just samba, but look at the variety of genres we're doing here.
There's kick flares and a waistline to that. That's
exactly
wonderful. Okay, let's move on. Finally, I think we're going to have something from, well, the culture minister of Brazil, frankly, has walked the walk, hasn't she?
Yes, but we have actually two more tracks.
Ah,
and the first one, we're going to play a very quick clip of this. I think this is actually going to be the number one song of this year's Carnival. His name is Léo Santana. A very handsome, 6'6" man. And again, there's apparently a petition of straight men in Brazil saying, please don't do your dance videos, otherwise our wives would be crazy about it. I mean, of course, this is a joke. But yes, he's handsome.
You never know in Brazil.
You never know, right?
No.
You never know. Let's have a quick listen to Léo Santana, Zona de Perigo, Danger Zone. Gostou seu pro pai e vem jogando de latinho.
Isso é Fortaleza, será? Just tell me, that, compared with all the others, sounds a Derek, gosh, goodness, no disrespect to Leo Santana, but it sounds a bit low rent.
It is a bit low rent, but I don't know what actually managed to connect. I think it's the sexy lyrics. She was kissing my mouth, touching the back of my head, I am enjoying. It's very descriptive song, and perhaps a little bit romantic, but I do agree with you, Emma. The beat is not there, energetic, but Brazilians
Neither
are loving it.
Neither do the lyrics sound it, frankly. I mean, it doesn't sound like an exact charmer. I can't imagine sitting next to him for the evening going, gosh, wowie with me those lyrics. All right, but obviously he hits the spot somewhere. So finally, I do want to hear about Margaret Menezes.
I mean, Margaret Menezes, she's our culture minister, and she's another Carnival queen. She's 60 years old now, but in fact, besides her jobs as culture minister, she will be performing this year's Carnival in João Pessoa. She's going to Bahia. There's a lot of tributes to her. She had an amazing music career. She's very much associated with Carnival. I chose to end the show a lovely track by her. It's called Faraó by Margaret Menezes. Let's have a listen. It's a very enjoyable track.
Música
she sort of delivered her political speeches in that style. I think, well, actually, frankly, any politician could learn from
that. That would be quite useful,
right? Well, it would get the message home. Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, thank you so much for our Carnival special. And that's all we have time for today's edition of The Briefing. Many thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Carlotta Ribello. Our researchers were Andrea Nicolai Parmentier, and our studio manager was Adam Heaton. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow, but for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.